This episode focuses on power and leadership, stepping into the power you have, learning to step out of it, and creating structures for First Nations leadership. You're going to hear from Kerry, who leads our long-term initiatives, and Ash, who plays a major role in our consulting business. And returning from previous episodes, you're going to hear from Mel, Lucy, and Carolyn, our CEO. Kerry lives, works, and plays on Paramac lands in the Adelaide Hills. Ash is on Gadigal lands, Mel on Bidjigal lands, and Lucy and Carolyn on Kaurna lands. I'm Chris. I'm on Kaurna land too, and I'd like to pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future.
My parents didn't have a huge understanding of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
I would say that I had no awareness about my white privilege and what that actually meant.
Trying to deal with this situation of racism, I was reinforcing that, and I was actually...
I felt that my approach of being respectful would be enough.
Try and move past that discomfort and not sort of sit in that and not take action, and to recognise that we might take missteps, but not...
Like, if I'm at work, but don't hesitate to take the step forward, or don't hesitate to ask that question.
Organisations out there need to have it entwined in everything. I think that's just the key. Otherwise, you just... say tick a box and it's done, and you forget about it and you move on with life, and it makes no difference. It doesn't change how you feel or how you react or how you think.
Kerry, tell me about your cultural learning journey. Where have you been?
Well, that's a big question because it's quite a long one. I think my cultural learning journey really started when I was a teenager, and my auntie and uncle moved to Alice Springs, and so a lot of kind of traveling back and forth, and just eyes really wide open to what was happening for Aboriginal communities, particularly around Alice Springs. And I particularly remember this point where my auntie took me out to one of the Aboriginal communities to meet the women who do the art that was actually then being locally unsold, like way more than they were being paid. And just to meet those artists, and in the end went back and bought a piece direct from them. And it just that whole, like, as a teenager, eyes open to actually, isn't it something not good going on here in relation to how Aboriginal people are treated? So I really mark that as quite a seminal point in my journey. Certainly that over many years, but I think at Tuxi, the commitment we've really made to really enable people to go on that individual journey, reconciliation and cultural learning as part of really strengthening who we are as a collective, I've never experienced anywhere else to that depth, working alongside Aunty Vicky over those nearly 9 years now has been quite a significant part of my journey. And I think with the Fighter Flourish program, that opportunity to actually put myself consciously in a space of being led by Aboriginal people and working with a majority Aboriginal team as we went out to visit communities, I saw it as a really important step in my journey, and what I could, that it would stretch and challenge. I had a lot to learn to step into that place to be truly, truly led by Aboriginal.
I took up a role to work in a relatively remote place called La Trinidad in Baguio. Baguio was is about 7 hours north of Manila, up in this region called the Benguet Province. It's in the big island of Luzon. It's a northern part of the Philippines. And further up from Baguio there are many, many different indigenous tribes and language groups that live out there. And they actually were some of the only people that both the Japanese as colonizers and the Americans weren't actually able to get beyond that in some ways, from my very rudimentary understanding. Happy for any sort of historians listening to this to check that a bit better, or maybe make it clearer for themselves. But for me, I was introduced to kind of the marginalization and oppression and the resistance and the resilience of indigenous peoples from that context initially, and also through some really great connections I made through my work there with other sort of international folk who had chosen to work in the Philippines and were invited to work there and so on, and them exposing me to the other sort of indigenous issues around the world, some of them from North America and Latin America and so on. And I also kind of fell in love at that point in time. I kind of met you know, this great lady who I met in the process of going to the Philippines. You know, she'd gone to another country, but she was going to pursue her PhD in remote Australia. And it was interesting with this person at that point where they were pursuing a PhD kind of around an indigenous community, and they were feeling really vulnerable about it themselves because of all the historic damage research has done with and for First Nations peoples in Australia. And I think I was also very, like, you know, green to understanding the issues and challenges from an Australian Indigenous context anyway. And I definitely asked some stupid questions, probably offended this person, but they were generous enough to kind of introduce me to some material to watch. I think they gave me a First Nations Australians DVD at that point, I remember. But I think, you know, it started in that very small way of kind of being exposed to it, but also me offending someone because they just thought, wow, this crazy guy is asking me to explain this entirely complex thing. But then I think I also then kind of made the decision for the relationship where they were just like, look, I don't think this is going to work. I can't take you into this remote community. Then I was, of course, super offended that me, this great traveler and person who's open to any culture, and somebody decided that I wasn't right for that, you know. So from that was around 2008, 2009, you know, I think you start to take small steps. All those kinds of lessons, you know, over time, you know, both from a personal, you know, experience, a sense of curiosity and general luck have kind of led me to, you know, my own journey of going deeper in it, you know, day by day. And then I think I'm at a place now where it's not just about all those nice things and the one-upping and the virtue signaling and standing on my little pedestal and kind of correcting people and all that. I've done that too. So it's cool. Maybe do that. Like, always, definitely, you know. I encourage people to, you know, do the spelling mistake correction, the flag color correction, you know, do all that, or tell someone else your sort of little wisdom that you read by reading Decolonizing Solidarity, whatever, up to you. You know, do that, make yourself feel good. But I think the step that you ought to take from that next is to really help the other person, the other context, the other situation, help them take their judgment a little deeper, perhaps by themselves, if you can. I've been lucky enough to have many, many interactions. And more importantly, in the recent 10 years, I've been able to explore my own way of being and thinking a little bit further, but with a little bit of care but also with a little bit of, like, openness to falling on my face. There's so many people who tell us, they gave me this great intense book to read and I read it and I felt so crap, but I just didn't know how to articulate or process it. You know, like, I would encourage people to be like, you just process it in the rawest form you can. But you just trust that the context will help you with it. Like, somebody will see that, this person's, they're trying to make sense of this, so we can help out. So I think we all have many opportunities like that to help each other in that and help yourself in that.
I had a lot of opportunity working directly with particular leaders from Aboriginal community or people from individuals from community, but less so working with majority teams of Aboriginal people. And certainly, I guess the roles I was playing, I was much more in a leadership role. You know, I had learned and knew that I've been able to demonstrate to my colleagues this level of cultural awareness and understanding. But then I was really in a situation where I was in a room where there were the Aboriginal team, and there was other people who non-Aboriginal, and really feeling both in words and body language where the discussion was going, this deep level of racism and different types of racism that were coming up in this situation. And actually, I think that's where I was really strongly put to the test around what does it mean to be an ally. And actually, in that moment, I didn't get it right, because I was feeling internally really uncomfortable about what I was seeing. But what I did was I stepped forward and I actually filled the space trying to deal with this situation of racism. And actually, in that, I was reinforcing that, and I was actually taking over the power and the space for them to be able to actually deal with that situation with non-Indigenous people in the room. And so, afterwards I got those of us who know, sometimes you get a growl like from the elder or the auntie, uncle, the more senior, and I certainly got that. And it was a really important point for me to stop and really reflect on, okay, you know, my intent there was like racism's not good enough, but actually in acting I had not helped that situation. So I think in some of the things that I've taken from that is really understanding and noticing my own internal churn and how to really quieten that down, and to keep, is a real strong practice for Aboriginal people around deep listening, to notice actually when that churn's happening, you're not deep listening, and to put yourself in that space. That deep listening means if I was in that space, I would have read the room, I would have seen where my Aboriginal colleagues were at, and would have probably sat much more quietly in that space, and they would have found their moment and way of challenging what was going on. So it felt significant, and I've just certainly taken that forward in a lot of other interactions that I've been having since. And found that if I do that, there's this moment where when it's right for you to kind of contribute to the discussion, you might, like, you'll feel it in the space, or you might have a quite explicit invitation to speak up at that time.
And you lead our consulting business, our social innovation consulting business. What's I was just wondering how allyship shows up in that, when we're, you know, trying to work with lots of different clients and potential clients, but coming at that with a particular view about kind of allyship and First Nations first.
Yeah, I think it really is evident in the way that we hold relationships and the work that we choose to do or not choose to do. And I think that's exemplified in those small decisions that we make. It's about deciding whether we might do this work and trying to understand the intent behind this work, the constraints around this work that may or may not allow for us to address the work in a way that we feel is appropriate to holding up reconciliation and holding up First Nations wisdom in that process. And so these things are those, you know, weekly sort of decisions and tensions about those constraints, the objectives of the work, and also just standing back and reflecting, are we the right people to do this work? And in many of those cases, we are not. And thinking about, well, what's our role in this? Is our role to reach out and create strong connections to other practitioners who identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders, and to be that bridge? Or is it about acting as a different type of bridge in the way that perhaps between white organisations and Indigenous communities, how can we create a safe space for both of those parties? What's our role in being that connector and that safe space, both for white organisations to step into this discomfort of the work in a way that it's okay to misstep, and vice versa, to have that sort of safety and cultural competency and barrier potentially between that organisation who's commissioning the work and the community that they want to engage in. So thinking about those things on a weekly basis and really bringing that in the way that we decide to do the work, how we build relationships, whether we consider, you know, the sort of constraints or the brief of the work.
Look, it's a pretty hard battle, like, in that. So I can give you like three distinct examples. One project was about trying to create a health record sort of system, but mainly focused on First Nations families, young people, mothers and children type thing. And in that instance, that project actually got kicked off, but the way we designed it was to say we will be working with local Aboriginal kind of peer researchers to do that work, to be able to actually, you know, design what maybe a prototype health record looks like, and, you know, with communities and so on. I would say that that was at least designed with a level of intent of ensuring that it was localized, and though we were coming from elsewhere, we were going to spend time building relationship in the community and then actually do that. That project got cancelled after we signed to do that and design that and so on.
We have been given the opportunity to support a think tank, is the sort of words that have been used, of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people from Victoria. They're from different countries across Victoria who are leading a think tank on culture, country, health and climate. We put in the application for funding to allow a number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to come together and figure out what they wanted to do at that time around those four topics of culture, climate, community and health, country and health. Yeah, I play a role in that in terms of I come along to the meetings and I'm essentially the sort of documenter. I'm a non-Aboriginal person myself, and I listen intently, and at the end of every session I recap to see if I've captured things correctly. And that just means that the people in the chat can really focus on what it is that they're discussing. They can really just take, follow the yarn where it needs to go, and know that they can always come back to the documentation if they need a reminder. And so, yeah, Ani Vicky and other folks in that group have just said that that's a really key role. And, you know, in future that might be an Aboriginal person as well, but there is something, interesting and potentially like valuable about having a non-Aboriginal person in there too. And we need to do some more work to figure out what that is, but that's come from the group too. So we might, have to have a think about the value of that. One thing that I do is play a bit of a bridging role between the funder and the group, so that they don't have to do that as well. the think tank has called themselves Yawa, which is a Boonwurrung word meaning journeying together. And that word was shared with the group by Steve Parker, who's a Boonwurrung man.
There's another project where it was about to do with like improving educational outcomes for young people in custody, and this was through the Department of Education. Now, we went back and forth on that, you know, so many different ways. If you think about the overrepresentation of our First Nations children and young people in custody, it's like totally out there, and yeah, we all, I mean, an appalling sort of state of affairs for us, and we all are constantly trying to work on and improve on that. And I kind of really battled, and you know, with that, with the Department of Education in New South Wales, to say, look, you know, what does it look like for us to kind of work with, you know, children in custody, and you know, could we learn from other examples? Or kind of tried all these different ways to make sure that we're not kind of going and causing more harm, but maybe learning from what's laterally around, and then kind of seeing if we can kind of present it that way. That one we just kind of decided not to pursue that, because we just felt we were going to be effectively just not moving the dial on that any more than where it's at, and we weren't given enough time to partner with another group. But I think in that instance, we recommended other people, other groups, that they should be working with other First Nations groups. Like, for example, UTS has an Indigenous research group, the Jimbana, you know, Research Institute, and so on. So kind of you recommend other groups who might consider that, consider doing the work. And a third example is a more recent one. This is about trying to kind of improve, kind of design this a future remote service model. Yeah, in that instance, I very much was like, I think there could be other groups who could do this. But then I took that a step further, where I said, well, it's cool that I can get others to do this, but maybe I'll first ask them if they've been invited. So I kind of actually contacted a couple of groups. And then one of them said, yeah, actually, we've been invited to do this. And then it was interesting, because then they were like, hey, maybe we should work together on this. You know, what do you think? And I just said, oh, yeah, sure, maybe, you know, but we think that you should do this, you know, because if you have connections. But they said, well, we might not have connections. We have connections in Queensland, but you might have connections in South Australia and New South Wales. So why don't we present that as an option? So we kind of work with the relationships that we have in our context. So in that instance, we effectively circumvented what they sent the same thing to two other people, but we came together and then we kind of presented our principles, their principles, and we said, we're going to model to you what a non-Indigenous-led social innovation group is doing to work in allyship, or in partnership, I should say, you know, and this is what it looks like. Here's the full design of this full, you know, experience of working together. And something happened to that project. They kind of did not go through with that project. So I think those are just three examples where there's different ways of like how I am trying to enact my influence and my awareness and my own evolution of what it means to work in allyship in very like practical, tangible ways at that point of like where budgets and money and urgency to like act out policy or design services all kind of happen.
And what are some of the things that you've done, or Taxi's done with the board, the Taxi board, to kind of bring this to the forefront and create that space for learning?
Yeah, so I think it was interesting, and it's something that we have, I guess, approached in a thoughtful and considered way. It's taken some time. You know, it probably took too much time. But I think one of the things with the board that I was really conscious of is each individual board member, you know, they had a lot of experience. They'd been on their own cultural journeys, some considerable ones at that, and how to, I guess, value and acknowledge that whilst then integrating them and bringing them along on ours. And so I think, first of all, bringing them on the journey of our reconciliation action plan and what that meant for us. It's also about talking to them about the work that we're doing, the relationships we're building. And then I guess most significantly over the past probably 6 months to a year now, we've replicated one of the core elements of a Taxi day-to-day routine into the board meeting, and that's the ritual of passing the stick, the cultural stick. And so now at every board meeting, a board member is holding the cultural stick, which means it's their time and it's their space. to bring cultural learning or experience or reflection to the board. And that can be anything from, we've had a board member actually really beautifully share the experience her children are on in their cultural learning, through to another board member talking to us about, I guess, the role of inclusiveness, diversity, and Aboriginal wisdom in impact investing. So it's beautiful how it brings out these really unique contributions of our board members that we would never otherwise see. So that's what we've done most recently. And at the beginning of next year, now we're coming out the other side of COVID, all of our board members are sort of going to walk the experience of our cultural induction at TACSI with Aunty Vicky and some other members of staff. So it's been something that we've introduced slowly, but I actually think it's probably one of their favourite parts of the board meetings, and directors have really embraced it, and I think are really, yeah, quite thrilled to be on that journey with the organisation.
We have had a couple of First Nations board directors at various times, and then we sat for a while without with a vacancy in that position, and that's not the case anymore. But I wondered your reflections on the TACSI board and on other boards as well, and the role of the challenges and opportunities of First Nations board members.
Yeah, I think that is such a big one, and I think I'm at the moment currently experiencing the benefits of having just an incredible board member, Sam Wild, we have on ours, who just brings so much cultural value and wisdom, but then her experience through her career brings all of these other remarkable assets that we are leveraging as well. And Sam has just been a spectacular addition to our board. But it really took us some time. You know, I think it can be so harmful to just have represent tokenism on boards and yet not find that person in a genuine and authentic way because of the value exchange that can happen between board and board member, but rather out of panic because you need to have, you know, an Aboriginal board member quickly. So we did, we took time and we did speak to a number of people. It really did take some time, and at times that was frustrating. But I think that it's quite remarkable now that we're able to work with Sam, and hopefully we'll be able to find other Indigenous directors we can bring onto our board. Similarly, though, I'm on other boards that are really struggling and really struggling to find that have a genuine commitment to be authentic and to really authentically engage First Nations wisdom and insight, but are just really struggling to find board members or to find people that want to put their hand up for that. It might be that they're too busy. Often, you know, people are on lots of other boards. So one particular board at the moment are looking to create, I guess, an opportunity for an Aboriginal person that's perhaps more new to the governance scene, and looking at how they can provide a development opportunity and scaffold it with some mentoring and some learning. And another board that I'm on, sort of going through the process of having lots of coffees and chats at the moment. So there are some real challenges, and I think, you know, we need to ask ourselves, first of all, how are we creating those sort of supporting, trusting, enabling environments that are culturally safe? But also, how do boards in some of their more traditional ways of operating enable First Nations wisdom to be brought to the fore? And perhaps if we could think more deeply about some of those things, we may be able to, put some more attractive offers on the table or create a more inviting space that Aboriginal people wanted to join in terms of, governing or helping to steward some of our organisations and institutions.
What's next for you on your First Nations learning journey?
I think for me, I'm very, very keen to pursue those relationships and actually demonstrate some real work, real projects, real sort of attempts at working side by side in at scale a little bit with all the different strategic action areas that TACSI is working on and continue to do that. A lot of my learning and evolution comes from actually giving it a real go, even if that doesn't work or it feels really tough. I think, but I kind of get energy from making that tangible, I suppose. I'm trying to keep it close to the things that I'm sleeping and waking up to every day, which is, you know, the work I'm passionate about and want to continue. Like I want to kind of tangibly demonstrate it in every interaction I have with all the public servants I work with and all the partners I kind of engage with and so on. I think, yeah, we can't underestimate that. I think there's a lot of influence you can have even in very critical conversations or in just critical questions or turning down a piece of work. I think, yeah, don't underestimate saying no in service of your allyship.
Well, I think I've really only just started on this journey of what it means to truly be led and actually to understand much more deeply what being a strong and helpful ally means. And, you know, as I reflected on the beginning, sometimes that means not doing something. It's about being there but not acting. So, yeah, for me it's, yeah, really deepening that journey. And really supporting, I think, my continuing to understand how I can support my colleagues in how they are able to set up Aboriginal leadership structures in the work we're doing with community.
Look, I think I'll just ask folks to kind of go easy and take it slowly. This is a lifetime of work, but don't hesitate to, I think the big thing is don't hesitate to take the step forward or don't hesitate to ask that question or don't hesitate to kind of act sometimes. Like, I think it's okay to kind of like, you know, don't ever feel like, oh, well, I don't know much about it, so I can't act on it. That's where things kind of, that status quo is kept as is because, you know, we all are scared to kind of take some steps. Can be very paralyzing, and I've been through many of those contexts where I'm like, oh, that's not my place to say this, that's not my place to do this, and then just, yeah, then everybody is doing the same thing. So maybe that as a thought.